Welcome to the M3 podcast. Your journey to movement, mindset, and medicine starts here.
Welcome back to another episode of the M3 podcast. It's me, your host, Mermaid Bree. And this interview episode is one that I've been super excited to share. It's probably been a few months now coming. And obviously from technical difficulties, this one was giving me quite a bit of resistance. I recorded this when I was on a remote island where my audio actually cut out and I needed to re-record my part in asking the interview questions. So giving you full transparency here, this took some re-editing and some work to get done that I ended up not posting interview episodes for a little bit because of that. So Ryan, I know, is an excellent person to have for this conversation, to bear patience for this. And I know that it was well worth the wait to get this out properly, because our conversations, that the things we talk about, whether it's substance abuse, you know, choosing vices, sitting with discomfort, being conscious, breath work, using our vessel, having the opportunity to be mentally and physically aware. And for somebody who is battling fires and is a full-time firefighter, to also be working with holistic health services and breath work, he has a company called Breathe for Flow that he works and facilitates either one-on-one or small group sessions. But I've also seen this person lead hundreds of people through breathwork sessions in a larger setting, with retreats, with different workshops. This person is here to help and offer their services in the best way possible, however possible, for the community and the people that need it. And to see someone simply show up in a place of gratitude, to mean it, to practice it, to clear their conscience of things that might be biased or judgmental, and to be able to reiterate the fact that they are human, they're not perfect, and that they're still conditioning themselves to continue to show up in the manner that they choose. So very proud of this person, all that they have to offer, and I'm excited to share a conversation with you all. Welcome back to another episode of the M3 podcast. It's me, your host, Mermaid Bree, and I have Ryan Anderson with us today, joining all the way from Arizona in the U.S. Yes?
Yep, Arizona, Phoenix.
Phoenix, Arizona. Woo! So I was introduced to you through one of our mutual friends, Pete Lemke. He and I had finished up an episode, and after his interview, I was talking to him about other people he might know, and he goes, you need to talk to Ryan. You need to meet with Ryan. I want you guys to share stories. This person has such a unique and incredible experience in their life. And it's cool to see, just from an outside perspective, someone who is putting out fires and now fueling their own fire with the use of their own breath. And so I like seeing that as an analogy shift for you. But Ryan, I want to hear a little bit of your background and your experience getting into the fire department, and what brought you to at least that chapter.
Cool. Yeah, thanks for having me and the nice introduction from Pete. That's nice to hear, because I look up to him and he's a good friend. So he's somebody that I always talk about highly of. So we could get into it. I've been a fireman for 19 years now. It seems like it flew by. I still probably have about 7 years left. I'd say early on in my career, I started to get into mental health. Obviously, it's tied to physical health. They're not separate. But, when you're 19 and you're testing to get hired on the fire department, you don't really know what you're getting yourself into. And you start to see some crazy stuff. And you start to be exposed to things that maybe you weren't quite prepared for. I don't think anybody really could prepare for something like that. So I'd say maybe 4 or 5 years into it, I started to really get interested in the nature of suffering, and like, why are people addicted to drugs, and what's wrong with the homeless people, and how do I deal with my own relationship to trauma, and my own mental health. And so it became a really interesting subject matter for me to get interested in early on. And I'd say about when I was 30, I'm 42 now, I had a back injury. And it was like 3 bulged discs and a tear. It was pretty significant. And it was a humbling injury because I felt pretty invincible before that. I felt like I was just a young guy and I could do pretty much anything. But that was a really humbling injury. And I was told I needed surgery and I was told to be put on pain meds. And that was my first introduction to the issues with the Western medical system. Not that it's completely broken, but just the approach. And that led me to studying yoga. And I never did take any pain meds, thank God. I lucked out on that because we had the internet. And I think the opioid crisis had already been pretty established at that point. So I missed that, which I was lucky for. A lot of people didn't, and it became pretty damaging to them. So I lucked out. I did discover yoga, which connected me to my body and my breath. I started to float in isolation tanks. That led me to deep meditation. I'd sort of just discovered things by being curious. And then that led me to being really interested in reading about Eastern philosophy and meditation and mindfulness. It led me to plant medicines, which were at the time not so popular. So I felt like I was a little bit alienated then and had to be really quiet about that. I think now they're becoming a little more mainstream, maybe not always in a positive way, but there's more science supporting that and there's more people becoming more open-minded to the benefits of those things. But yeah, that's a trajectory of how I got into breath work, which is something that I do. I've been facilitating breath work for 3 years now, large groups of people. I do individual sessions. I do couples. A lot of entrepreneurs will hire me for retreats and things like that where they want to get their team to connect on a deeper level. Athletes hire me. So it's been really fun to see that take off unexpectedly. But yeah, we can start from there and start picking it apart if you'd like. That just seems like a good beginning.
Let's go back to the suffering. You had mentioned that you were, and first of all, if you look at your social media page, I love that you say that you are passionately curious and your Instagram handle is a wonder junkie. So you have this kick or drive to learn more. You're very curious. You have a sense of wonder. And that led you to wondering about why people suffer. Was there a personal relationship to that suffering or something that maybe triggered?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. I think that was the first thing I started to realize in the float tank, actually, was how uncomfortable I was being still with myself. And I hadn't even really been exposed to meditation at that time, not even the concepts of it. I just heard about it on a podcast and I drove across town and I paid for it, got inside the tank, and I realized how busy my mind was. And that was uncomfortable. And so I wanted to get out, but I didn't because I paid the money. And that became my first experience with myself, you know, with a true encounter with consciousness. And I thought, man, if I can't be alone with myself for an hour in this tank, there's something wrong, right? And I think that's the cultural issues that we have in the West is that we praise momentum, we glorify it, we reward it. And that's not a bad thing. It's just the way our culture presents itself. And if you go into the Eastern philosophies, you start to see that they actually look up to the ideas of self-reflection and time alone and inner engineering, if you will. And so I went back quite a few times, and I think my third float was a big one for me. I remember starting to observe my thoughts. They weren't me. And that was really cool because I didn't know that you could even do that. So I started to become identified more with the observer. And I didn't know what I was experiencing. I was very new to it. I didn't have the language for it. So I began to read about it. And I started to find Carl Jung and started to find a lot of different answers through books and podcasts and YouTube videos. And it really woke me back up to my own spirituality even. It made me question my belief systems. It made me realize that half of my life, maybe more than half, almost my whole life, I had been basically automatic. I was almost in an automatic cultural conditioning. And I think all of us have that experience at some point or another where you have a wake up moment or an aha moment, the matrix. And it's scary. It can happen with a near death event. It can happen with a traumatic event. And for me, I think that's actually what I ended up discovering caused the back pain. It was just me being busy and not paying attention to my body, not being embodied. You know, that's the whole basis of yoga, the union. And I started to get really curious about the nature of my own suffering. And I think that's a beautiful journey. It takes courage to do that. And at the time, I know people thought I was weird, you know, the floater guy or the hippie guy. And, you know, it's hard to relate to people when they maybe haven't quite had an experience like that at the time. But I was lucky to have podcasts and books, and I was able to find teachers and people that had been studying this field for thousands of years. So that helped me to feel secure going forth on the path and realize that there was people just like me for all of human history that I could relate to. And I started to really pay attention to the culture at large and see that people avoid the discomfort, right? It's natural, including myself. And so when you start to spend some time in nature, spend some time alone, and you self-reflect, that's where you get answers. And that's where you start to discover who you truly are, your true self, and what you actually stand for. And you actually get to sort of see your belief systems. And I think it's really beautiful to start writing them down and start communicating them and start to negotiate with yourself which ones you stand for and which ones you want to eliminate. And you start to feel a little bit alienated from your older version of yourself. And that can be pretty destabilizing. It's not exactly an easy journey, especially if you do it radically and fast with plant medicines or something like that, because it can be too much, too quick for some people. So I don't recommend those things. I'm very conservative when it comes to that stuff. And if people are going to consider altering their consciousness, they should know that there's a lot of preparation and integration involved in that whole circle, and to be very careful what influences those experiences, because you're very suggestible, including the music you listen to, the people you surround yourself with, the books you read. So I'm really big on just paying attention to what I'm paying attention to and trying to choose my relationship to my experience and choose how I feel and how I think to the best of my conscious ability.
I'm absolutely speechless right now. That was very well said. And there's so many areas I want to touch back on. Number one is you had mentioned the observer. And you had said, with the observer, we are not our thoughts. And I think back to books like Jay Shetty's Think Like a Monk, The Yoga Couples, The Inner Work, The Big Leap I'm reading right now with Gay Hendricks. There's many different components to the thought process, but they're not who we are. And we identify with those thoughts often. And even those who are conscious and aware as the observer, sometimes human instinct gets us to want to connect, and it's our protective defense mechanism to connect ourselves to those thoughts and think that that's our reality. So as you're sitting in the floating and you're sitting there uncomfortable, I think of many people who talk about, and I'm just, you know, an example that in real time is I'm in a very remote island right now. Sumbawa Island is a very tiny island in Indonesia where the power is going on and off. And I didn't mention it to you before because I'm praying that, you know, all is working out well and we just have power for this entire hour, but power is going off and on all day long. There's a lot that makes this a very tiny place that you get island fever. And I have people who are running out of their vices that they traveled with that are very uncomfortable sitting with their thoughts right now. And you can tell that it's a lot from the person connecting to their thoughts, not as the observer, reaching for those vices, reaching for that place of comfort because they don't want to sit in the uncomfortable, even when they're in nature or even when they're meditating or in a float tank, things that should be healing. You have all the tools in front of you. You're there. You know what to do. But there's still a human aspect to it. So why do you feel that people have vices? Number one question. Number two, who is the observer? How do we shift from ourselves outside of our thoughts to become the observer? And then question three is, how can we sit in the uncomfortable?
Those are big existential questions that maybe we don't have the answer for. Maybe we can say we don't know, but that's where the journey begins, is the curiosity and the wonder. And the unknown to me is the mystery. That's the beauty of life. And I think that's something that we have been avoiding. You know, it, to me, faith is actually letting go and surrendering and going forth and pursuing the unknown, right? And the original story of the Western text is to stay in the garden of ignorance and to not eat from the fruit of the tree of knowledge, or you will be cast astray. But the Gnostics and other great people that have lived and have been burned at the stake and maybe even been persecuted for expanding and getting out of the garden of ignorance as a metaphor, as a psychological metaphor. It's the individual hero's journey to go after the cave that you fear. You know, it's where the treasure is, right? There's many, many different narratives that you could go back to that are very similar. But I think the reason people have vices and, you know, they want to go for the quick dopamine hits or the addictive behavior, that's a subject that I even spent the last 5 months studying. And I've been reading about it my whole life. It's fascinating. And I'm very blessed that my nature and that my experience so far on this planet, I've had a pretty decent baseline physiology, and I don't deal with too much of that. I'm lucky. So I even have a different type of burden where I have to serve and find ways to help others. Otherwise, I'm feeling guilty and shameful because I'm not doing enough with what I was given. Being born in the right time, in the right place, with the right people, without that much trauma, with my basic hardware working good, my basic physiology is operating well. So you see suffering and you can't just bliss out and keep going on the next self-help retreat when you know there's actually stuff to get done. And so anyway, I think if you want to get into the nature of addiction, it really is just be curious about it, be humble about it, in my opinion. And if you want to have compassion for people that are dealing with something that you just can't understand, I used to have the old school mindset of like, why are you doing that? Why don't you just stop? And why can't you be disciplined like me? And it took me some years to get more humble and realize, like, I'm lucky. And I don't know, like, even my sister, who's had quite the difficult life, and my cousin and people around me that I've seen kill themselves. I mean, I've seen the worst of the worst. And I go into people's homes that are, you couldn't even imagine. And so, of course, I'm curious about the nature of suffering and why. Why are people in these states? And I don't know. I know a lot more than I did know. And I probably realize that the more you go into it, the more you realize you just don't know. So be humble and help, you know. And one of the best ways that I know I can help is to take care of myself, stay on the right path, because I'm no further away from it than others. If I got hit by a car and I was a quadriplegic, or if I lost a loved one, or God knows what could happen that's out of my control, how am I going to show up and how am I going to relate to that experience? And I'd hope to think that I could do my best to make do, but man, there's a lot of things that happen to people, especially before they're even aware of what's happening to them in the womb. Even if you get into past lives, you start to study that, the ancestral trauma. And, you know, not that we're identified or victimized by trauma, because that's an overused word, but it is a big subject and it's fascinating. And I think just getting curious about it and approaching it with humility is a beautiful place for anyone to consider starting, instead of thinking you have the answers. So that's your first question. I think your second, what was the second one?
Who is the observer, and how can we shift our thoughts into becoming the observer?
So for me, I mean, I can never speak for anyone else. My experience is all I can ever really speak from. It requires the discipline to slow down. And in my breathing groups that I create for people, all I've done is tried to create space for people. I basically tried to create the experience that I'd want to go to myself, and that I'd want to bring my mother to, and that I could bring my fire captain to, or people that I know. Because a lot of times people are intimidated to go to the yoga studio, or they're intimidated to go to any kind of retreat, because there's a lot of costume and soft talking, and there's the beads and all the stuff that goes with it. And that's not bad, but it's just not going to fit maybe the conservative Christian or the Mormon or the average plumber or just people that want to feel good. And so I thought I could bridge that, the world that I was dabbling in, all the things that I was learning, and make it approachable and accessible to anyone. So I create an environment where people can truly trust themselves. They can lay there the whole hour if they want and do nothing, because the fact that they showed up, took courage, to drive across town to try something where they're going to have to connect with themselves and feel, which is what we're all afraid of, and actually have to confront our inner stuff, which is why we stay busy and hit the next piece of sugar or TikTok video or whatever the addictive behavior is. So right off the bat, I try to just be present, be of service, be kind to these people, know that they've already shown up and done something a little bit difficult just by showing up. And then when they show up and they're like, I've never done anything before, I've never touched breath work, I've never done, it's like, let's make it light and playful. You can lay there and listen to us get weird. You don't have to do anything, like truly put it back in their power. And then you give them some nice tools, and I give them long, slow anchor breaths, which is actually difficult because slowing down takes courage, because that's when you feel, and it's easier to get busy than it is to be still, right? It's always easier to find the next thing. And so I just help people with the right music, the right environment, and the right energy to slow down. And a lot of people need guidance for that. It took me a long time to learn how to do that on my own, but I had teachers and I practiced and explored it for years and years and years before I ever considered sharing it. And then I realized, like, it's almost rude of me not to help people in this dimension. So give people a nice, slow, grounding anchor. And then when they feel safe, I give them permission and tools to ramp it up and to induce conscious stress if they want to sweep it out and to let go. And to actually, when you start to breathe in a circular pattern in the right environment, you can actually move everything that you can imagine out of the body. It's incredibly powerful. I'm very careful with my words. I talk about gratitude, resilience, strength, opening your heart, the basics, because you're in a suggestible state. It's very powerful. So I'm very careful with my words, and I only give words of encouragement. We move energy in the body. We move energy, and people sometimes, there's no filming. There's no, this is a sacred space, so there's no putting it on social media. And it's a very psychedelic experience, and it is free. It's safe. It's effective, and it works. And so to get in touch with that, you have to slow down, and it's hard. So it's not like, it sounds easy, just slow down, hit the brakes, but a lot of us are not, we don't even know that we have brakes. So I help people discover and remember that they have incredible brakes and that you can downregulate your nervous system with your breathing. You feel the power of the breath by doing it, and then you probably start to build the relationship with the breath because you've started to feel it. And once you feel it, you don't forget it. You know, so it's not an intellectual thing. It's not a lecture. It's just, it's a powerful experience. And then each time you come back, you start to realize, oh, I can trust this space, this person, this environment. So they go deeper and then they start to confront. And a lot of times it's just subconscious memories that they never knew they had, or it's nervous system stuff that you let go of. Get into Peter Levine's work and a lot of the somatic work. And it's really about just resetting the nervous system. And you don't even know how it works intellectually, but when you get out of there, you feel better. And then a lot of integration and things like that, which I'm tied to a lot of beautiful people, being true to you community and others that are really amazing people that know how to help you integrate your experiences after you leave. And anyway, that's a little bit of what I do in the breath work. Give people tools and techniques to learn how to slow down and to find that other part of themselves, their deeper selves. And maybe they don't even know that's why they're coming and that's what's happening, but that is what's happening. So you had number two. I think I've done a decent job of helping you to see how I personally access that part of myself. And that usually comes from some form of slowing down. Writing is beautiful. I've used writing for many years. I read a book called The Right to Write by Julia Cameron. And that was good because it gave me permission to just start journaling and streams of consciousness and starting to put down my abstract emotional and inner world. And when you start to write things out, it becomes like a really clear map. And then you can actually change your map and build maps from there. So I'm a big fan of writing. But I think a good starting point for people is to learn how to slow down. And it's not easy. So you can use a float tank. You can go to a good breath teacher. You can call me up. I'll do it. I love doing even online stuff where we can talk about it and you can just feel the breath. And that helps you to get there. And then when you're laying in bed at night, you can start doing it on your own. And it might take a little while, but it comes.
The third question that I had for you was, how do people learn to sit with their discomfort? Because when you are somewhat uncomfortable, you reach for vices, whether it's alcohol, sex, drugs, gambling, socializing, overworking, people pleasing. There's ways that we find these vices to give us that bit of dopamine that make us feel better. And also people are doing things like cold plunging and sauna and meditation and breath work and yoga and going to these retreats and saying how they're feeling better and they're healing. But are they actually healing? Are they able to fully process and integrate what it is that they're learning and practicing and applying it to every part of their lifestyle?
That's a great question. And I think we all get caught in that, especially when you start to go down this path. You get 80% of your return on the first 2% of the journey. So it's this big return in the first beginning, whether it be a plant medicine or a float tank or whatever your breathwork experience, it's a powerful return. And then you're like, wow, if I double down and keep going, I'm going to get to be a Jedi master, as like Jamie Wheel would say. And it's not true. So it becomes a form of obsession. And you see it, especially in the yoga world or the spiritual communities, that it can be its own form of busyness, you know? And that's, I try not to judge it, but I try to catch myself, you know, too, getting busy. Because busyness is a form of laziness, and it's easier to get busy. And so you just start to pay attention. And I love, there's a teacher I found named Jon Kabat-Zinn. He introduced this practice called mindfulness-based stress reduction to hospitals. MIT guy, Western thinker, he's from Boston, I believe, and he went over and studied Eastern philosophy for many years. But then he came back and stripped it all down and made it approachable. And what he ends up talking about that I love is just, it's the everyday stuff. It's chopping vegetables. It's taking a shower. It's driving your car. It's like when you're chopping the vegetables, you're chopping the vegetables. When you're at work and I'm talking to Chaz and I'm with the guys, I try my best and I'm not good at it, but you don't judge it. It's just non-judgmental awareness. And you do your best to just catch yourself in your head and wanting to do something else and do more. It's like, life is fleeting and passing you by most of your days, and 98% of it, you weren't even aware that you were there, right? And you don't have to go to the weird retreat and do ayahuasca, because we've only had planes to get to the jungle to do this type of stuff for a couple, 20 or 30 years. And you don't have to get in the cold plunge. You don't have to do the saunas. Sometimes the average plumber is more enlightened than the average yogi. You know, they're a good husband or a good father. They're patient with their kids. They're loving, and they don't know anything about any of this shit that we're talking about. So I've learned that it's not the, there's a lot of obsession, right? And a lot of people like ourselves, we want to push ourselves, we want to grow, and we're in this growth mindset. And, you know, sometimes we have to pump the brakes, go, hey, hold on, just enjoy your day, be grateful. And for myself, gratitude is the ultimate medicine. And so it's the, and it's thrown around a lot, and it's this word that I think we abuse. But it's a state, and it doesn't take long to really just pay attention to the fundamentals of what you can be grateful for. And if you sit alone with yourself and you start to practice it, it is a cultivation, just like a muscle or a stretching program where you get better at it. At least for me, when I say you, I mean me. And I like to go into closing my eyes and I pay attention to the basics. I'm having some form of awareness. Something's happening from nothing. I have a body, I have lungs, I live in some sort of crazy, complex world. You can get rid of all the narratives and stories and belief systems and look at the principles of life, which is like, wow, this thing is crazy, right? And you're in it. You're not separate from it. Wow. So you're in awe. And there's awe and wonder, and you're grateful. To me, you can't feel bad if you're in that state. And then you move forth into your day with that state. And I think you can cultivate a state of gratitude and presence and awe and wonder and curiosity. I mean, that's truly what I try to live by, is just be playful, joyful, present, curious. Don't be too hard on yourself. I tell myself these things. And at the end of the day, you know, we're all going to be dead soon. I say that all the time. People sometimes like, ooh, that's dark. It's like, it's true. You know, and everything is a death. This interview will be over soon. The fire department will be a beautiful chapter that comes to an end, and I'll miss it. I'm going to miss cooking with the guys and hanging out with them and I hope I was there for most of it and I wasn't in my head wishing I was doing more. Because that's the trap, is like, I should be doing more. I should. And I hate the word should. I've actually built a relationship with it where I'm like, should, who is that? And it's usually culture and conditioning. And it's the root of most Western suffering. You know, if you're in Peru, like Don Howard, one of my teachers, friends, mentors, I got lucky to spend a lot of time with this beautiful man. And he was in his 70s when I met him. And he would take us on these boat rides up the river on Huachuma, which is like this incredible heart-opening cactus medicine. And the point of the journey was to meet these indigenous tribes that had absolutely no material possessions, and they were so joyful. And maybe we couldn't speak the same language, but we could smile with them, we could dance with them, we could eat with them. And they were just freaking happy. They had no electricity. And it was so humbling, because in that super suggestible open space, you're having this incredibly deep relationship experience with these people, and it's life-changing. That was probably one of the most profound experiences I've ever had. We did it multiple times in a week, and I just remember to this day, I always think of those people when I think I need to go and get a new Forerunner, or I need to get, you know, upgrade my membership at the gym, or, you know, we get caught in all this programming of TikTok and Instagram, and you need to be successful and you need to be growing. And it's like, that could be cancer. That could just be growth for the sake of growth, which is a cancerous mindset. I'd rather be content and grow from a place of gratitude and joy. And because I think that a lot of times we're growing because we need something, right? It's almost like you're seeking because you're lacking. And that's not wrong. Maybe that's the reason we have iPhones and all this cool stuff, right? But for me, I just want to find the right peace inside. And so I try not to get too swept into the spiritual seeking too much anymore. I've been on that boat. It leads to the same trap. You know, sometimes it's better just to stay home and do some breath work and lay on the couch and not go to the next workshop or to call your mother, you know?
I mean, it's hard because as coaches or as facilitators, like, who are we to tell people what they can and can't do or what they should and shouldn't do? And we're here to help guide people and show them a way, show them a path. But we're not here to determine and say, like, if you do journaling, meditation, breath work, you know, yoga, all of these retreats, all these healing practices, that you're just going to snap your fingers and feel better. And I think people tend to think that if I just do these things, if I just follow the program, if I complete and utilize every tool I have in my pocket, like, everything's going to be fine. But, like, shit keeps happening. Life happens. Like, these things continue. And it's up to us to figure out how to resource these tools when we need it to root ourselves back to our true intentions and our true morals and who we want to express ourselves as in this world. And it happens. It tends to happen that we can be shifted out of our character, shifted out of our morality, and things will tempt us, or things will, you know, get us off of our rocker. And so I'm curious, how can this help people who don't fully understand how to process and sit with their discomfort?
Well, I'm careful to tell people what to do again. And I also don't have it figured out. I'm like, oh, I'm just as confused as everyone else. We're all doing our best. But I do know for me, what works is little micro habits. Like, I have morning rituals that are solid and they keep me healthy. I don't mess around with those too much. You know, for the most part, my morning rituals of, you know, the cold and the heat and the movement and the breath and reading. And it's just like, that's an incredible part of my day that then, you know, when something stressful happens in my life, it's like, at least my base is pretty solid. And I think if we don't have a good morning ritual or some form of good habits, I mean, that's all we are, is just patterns. And so I try to keep consistent patterns and think about the patterns of the mind. Patterns of the body are easy as long as you put them in and you have 20-minute, you know, disciplinary practices. But patterns of the mind are the uneasy ones. And so those are the ones to me that are the most important, because you can't be disciplined and you can't do those embodiment practices half the time if your mind's not right. and they're not separate. So it's funny to think about them as separate, but they're not. But I think gratitude, to me, it's like journaling about it, being the accountant. Like, it's almost like your bank account and your finances. If you don't pay attention to it, you don't measure it, you're not going to know where your money's going. And so you get a spreadsheet out and you start to like organize your finances and go, okay, here's what's coming in. Here's where my savings is. Here's where I'm investing, blah, blah, blah. With gratitude, it's the same thing. You can count for an infinite list what's going wrong. And your mind wants to do that. Your amygdala and your survival mechanisms that we've evolved for, I think, seek what's wrong. And we're conditioned through social media and the mainstream media. People watch it and people around are in fear. And it's like, there's a lot of stuff that's just bombarding, especially like during COVID. It's all propaganda and they're trying to keep people in fear to either just capture attention or to sell products or whatever the underlying incentive is to drive people's fear. So it takes a lot of extra in this day and age, I think. You know, we're not running from saber-toothed tigers. We're not running from bears, but we're being bombarded. Our attention's being bombarded with these propaganda machines to sell you bullshit. So we have to be really good accountants, and we have to start taking account for what's going right. And that's what I was saying with the breathing practice. You can do a 2-minute breath practice or a 5-minute breath practice. I mean, I have so many breathing practices now, it becomes like my whole day is a breath practice. That sounds crazy, but it's because that's a mindfulness practice. So if I'm pushing the sled, it's a breath practice. If I'm working out, it's a breath practice. If I'm in the sauna, they're all different styles of breathing because I've gotten obsessed with it. But in the morning, right before I get up and do anything, I take 3 long, slow, deep breaths, and I think about how lucky I am to be alive, awake, and aware at all. And that truly works. It's like, that's your prayer. And I think if you get rid of all the religious context and you just go to the fundamentals, which anyone can do, praying is basically communicating with what is communication with God? I mean, it's different for everyone. It's like just being grateful is the ultimate prayer. It's like, damn, are you going to just be bitching about the circumstance and be a victim of it? Or are you going to be lucky? Even if it's, God forbid, you're in the Holocaust, like Viktor Frankl, or God forbid you know, your girlfriend broke up with you, or whatever the circumstances, you should still be grateful. So I just try to cultivate a practice of it. And I've been lucky to have that intuitively early on. I think I was pretty lucky feeling when I was a kid, because I'm adopted and my sister's adopted and we have 2 different biological families. And I remember being very young and just being like, wow, I was praying and I was saying thank you to have these amazing parents that like chose me. And they don't abuse me. They love me and they give me food and shelter and all this stuff. I'm like, I could have been born into God knows what, or not born because I was aborted. So I chose early on, I don't know why, to not be a victim. And I actually think victimhood is the ultimate parasite on the mind. And I think people sell it. You know, it's pushed into the school systems. It's pushed into the commercials, because if you're a victim, you can sell me the next product, the next workshop, the next whatever you're trying to give me, and I'm not empowered. And so I really think if we can, I know there's free will here, and I know there's a little bit of choice, but if you can actually choose meaning and choose your relationship to your experience, regardless of your circumstance, your burdens, your whatevers, and I'm a white male in the middle of 2024, it's like people could say, well, who are you to say that you to be grateful? It's like, well, you know, you don't know my story. You don't know what I've seen. You don't know my burdens. I don't know yours. And everyone has different degrees of trauma and suffering. And at the end of the day, we're conscious human beings and we're all going to be gone. So let's try to be a little bit more kind and loving and grateful. And I just become an accountant and I try to be the accountant for what's going right first, and then start counting what's wrong and where I could fix things. So that's what I do.
How beautifully explained your service is to others, and the state that you show in consistently to be grateful, to thank your opportunities, thank your situations, thank the circumstance, right? Because we never know where the blessing in disguise could be. And you've even said that I'm adopted. I have parents who chose me. I'm loved. I am cared for. How amazing is it, my life? Like all these things you have, you show up in that place of gratitude. And I think of it where Oprah Winfrey has taught me that saying thank you is the greatest prayer. And you just said that right now. to be in gratitude is to show up in the greatest form with the greatest prayer. And so I admire that. I see that. And just like you said, that's what I do. This is how I help people. I do that as well. And I love being able to be a retreat facilitator, a breathwork facilitator here in the near future. I've been given opportunities to do that, to finish my certification, to be a yoga facilitator, to be a fitness facilitator, to be a podcast facilitator and a host, right? So all of these different areas, I get to share messages, expressions, validations, acknowledgements for people to feel that sense of love, being heard, that compassion that I strive for, the compassion that I live for. And I'm here for it. You know, if I'm not going to be the person who can be that expert or facilitator for you, I'm going to outsource or share my expertise, knowledge, and resources and connections with other people who do know, because I may not know. And that's okay to say as a coach or a healer or a facilitator, you don't always know the answer. It's okay to not know everything. We're not God, but we are here to help, hopefully help people with the path that we've led.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah. And you know, the I don't know part, I think would be very good for people to start subscribing to. You know, we're taught in school to have the answers and that you get rewarded for answers. And that's an indoctrination method as well. Not to say we're victims of that, but it's a byproduct of the way we drive our system to be educated. And a true scientist or explorer is always in the unknown. You know, there's little bits of known, and then there's infinite unknown. And the more you know, the bigger and weirder and more interesting it gets. So we should never think that we know all the answers, or the righteousness of humans is what's gotten us into all the wars and all the struggles, and it's divided us. And a little humility goes a long way. And I'm speaking from experience. I've been there and I'm still there, and I'll always be trying my best to just get a little more humble and realize I don't know shit, you know?
I think that's such a great approach to go about it. And I also see people facilitate or lead or guide their paths, their healing experiences with people in such a unique way. I'm curious to know how you facilitate, how you lead others. Where do you start? Can you guide me through one of your breathwork facilitations from start to finish, what it looks like when you lead somebody or you lead a small group or you lead a large group? Is it scary for people? Is it nerve-wracking? What's the process like? How do you do what you do?
I think my approach is to just create space for people to go within and to connect with themselves, because even like in school, I was really always, I hated school and I love learning, but I had a different, you know, we all grew up in a certain type of education system. And I always thought it was ridiculous to be told what to read and then be told, you know, to go and do a report on that. It's like, how about you light fires, not the filling buckets, right? If they would have told me to pick a book on the subject matter I was interested in and gave me some options, I'm sure I would have been a ferocious reader like I am now. You know, I read a book a week. But when I was a kid, I hated it because it was work. And so someone was telling me what to learn. And I think if you get out of people's way and you give them freedom, every individual is so unique. You know, there's a quote I've heard, I forget who said it, but it's like, don't ask what the world needs most. Instead, ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs most is more people to come alive. And to me, that's like invigorating, because each individual has, with all their collective experiences, with their genes, there's so much complexity to you when you're born. You're already an old thing. Your genes, your hardware, you could go into archetypes if you want to. You don't have to get that deep. But you're already a complex base. And then you start to see culture. And if you're born in Japan or you're born in China or you're born here, your programming is the stuff that we actually have to learn how to unlearn. Most of the beauty in learning now is unlearning. And that takes time, space, courage. That's what the floating is. That's what the breath work is. So I create containers for people to access their consciousness. And for each person, it's going to be so different. And if it's someone that's coming with a lot of stress and anxiety, maybe they're just trying to learn how to manage to where they can even feel comfortable being still. You know, and if it's someone that's a psychonaut and they want to come and they're exploring, and who knows, everyone's in such a different place. But in each person, when you slow down and when you go into these realms, because when we induce stress with the breath too, it becomes a non-ordinary state of consciousness and it becomes a surrender experiment. And you have to learn how to either let go or you come back to your anchor. It's like exposure therapy. You can back off and you pump the brakes and go, I'm not ready to go there tonight. So it's very permissive versus if you take a plant medicine, you're buying the ticket, you're on the ride, and there's no going back. And so that's not necessarily always a good idea. So this is like a good way to pass out legal states of consciousness in the right container and let people create it themselves. And then they get to ease in and ease out and ease in and ease out. And then they trust themselves. And it's just learning how to really trust yourself and not someone outside of you, not some authority. I present zero authority when I'm there. It's very much you. And I think that's what I teach for now. I mean, that's what I feel safe enough to do with my background and my knowledge and my mentors and my experiences, is to like help people feel safe, contained, and like give them permission to explore consciousness in that way. It's legal. I mean, I don't have to worry about the feds kicking the door in. There's a whole bunch of reasons why I found breathwork to be the thing that I feel qualified to share. So that's what I try to share with people. I never give people books. I tell them to find books and authors and teachers that they are curious about, because each person's so different.
I feel that as a nutritionist, where somebody sees another person's program where they had success, they had a crazy transformation, and they want to do exactly what that person did to a T, follow their program, when not everyone is the same, not every shoe fits the same, not everyone's breathwork experience is going to be the same. And so when you go in and you have these intentions, it's like, what will your healing outcome look like? Everyone is different. So I'm curious to know, what do yours look like?
It depends on if I do one at the house here in the backyard where they started. It's a nice, cozy, private backyard. That's nice. It's outdoors. I tell people to bring blankets and things to be comfortable in. If it's at the studio, you don't need to bring anything. You can just show up and try not to have expectations. And I think I don't give people too much anticipation or expectation on the front end. I try to get people to show up and just try to be curious. And so what it looks like is you show up. It's not really a tribe. It's not a community. It's people from all walks of life. Each time is different. People always bring their loved ones. And, you know, if you come for your first time, you come back the next time, you usually bring somebody because you're like, wow, this is awesome. And you lay down. I do a nice brief introduction as to how it's going to look. We talk a little bit about what could happen. You might start feeling numbness and tingling and vibration in the body. You might have subconscious memories come up. You can have a lot of sensations. And if you don't like the way it feels, we go back to the anchor breath. And while I'm talking about breath work in the beginning, I show people and I let them feel the anchor. So they're feeling the anchor while we're talking about where to come back to, so that they have it built in. And then we spend the first, I'd say, 6 or 7 minutes in the anchor, which is like a long, slow inhale, really slowing down, and then constricting the throat and really lengthening the exhale, 10 or 15 second exhale. And you really, the music plays a big role. I build new playlists every single time. And they go with the whole session of how you're going to be breathing. And basically, we're building a journey. And then we give people permission to start breathing in a circular pattern. A lot of people call it holotropic breathwork. There's different names for it, rebirthing. And I think a lot of those places that I've trained with and sessions I've learned from and teachers, they're amazing, but they're also pretty intense. And so I don't go too deep, too far, too intense with people. They can if they want to, but I'm big on like exposure. Give people the experience of the power of the breath. But then if they want to go and build a relationship or go further, they can go do that. But for most of my sessions, it's like we go up, we cultivate a little bit of, we influence the body, the nervous system, and then we slow it down. And so there's a lot of ups and downs and ups and downs, just like life. And it gets uncomfortable and it gets weird. And, you know, there's people crying over here. And then there's people over here that might be just blissed out. It's different every time. And by the end of it, you've connected with yourself for an hour and you've moved energy in the body and you've changed your physiology and you feel better.
Do people get time to sit and share or journal or meditate and reflect on their experience with you within that time frame from their breathwork session?
A lot of times it depends on the environment that I'm in. If I'm at the yoga studio, I'm limited on as much time as I'd like, but the ones at the house, people have plenty of time to sit, and a lot of people like to share with one another and journal and talk. And a lot of times people just want to be quiet and alone, and some people just want to go home. So I'm very much like, we're not going to make people speak. I do sharing circles often, and those are more what I call listening circles. And people have the opportunity to speak, and we pass a stick around, and you get to just share your vulnerable experiences if you want. But if you don't, just holding space for others and listening is very powerful. Some of the most powerful experiences of my life were sharing circles in Peru with Don Howard, and you'd hear things from people that you could completely relate to, and then you'd hear things that you couldn't even imagine. And it helps you to realize that people that you know back home that are suffering, you see someone right in front of you that tells you something just completely painful or whatever, and it just helps you to love people more and connect with them and realize, man, people are going through so much. And so that's beautiful. And I love sharing circles. I do those quite often. So, and there's never any pressure to speak.
I feel like it's all about having a safe space. If you can find this safe space in your home, in a group setting, if you go to a retreat, if you take a solo trip and you explore and you adventure. I do that where I go to Hawaii and I go on these retreats. I go to Bali and I do yoga teacher training. I do exploring. I do adventuring. And I want to create safe spaces like I've experienced to help people feel fully able to express themselves. And again, heard, acknowledged, seen, loved, all of that be poured onto them. That's what I want.
Mm. That's beautiful. Yeah, that's so true. We shouldn't have to go all the way to Peru to find that. But sometimes we're lucky to find those spaces, and they're in other countries, you know? I never thought I'd find myself facilitating breath work or any of this stuff. It was just following the path, and it's where I'm at for now. This is what I'm sharing for now.
What brought you to becoming a breathwork facilitator? Was this something you envisioned from the past or you worked really hard towards, or was it just brought upon you and you were like, there's no denying this?
I mean, I have a different approach to things where I don't try to envision too much, because there's a brief example is, this is going to help you to sort of see why I'm going to get to what I'm going to get to. But when I went to Peru, I went to Don Howard's last ceremony, and I didn't know that because he was dying of a rare blood disorder. And so I show up to Peru after waiting 7 years to go on this trip, because I did all my research and I was like, I was patient. I didn't just rush over there and say I need to check some boxes on my psychedelic passport, you know. So I was careful and I did my research, and when I felt called to go, I went. And I showed up to this beautiful place that didn't have much marketing at all. It was all old school. He'd been down there 30 years. And I meet this man, and he gives me these 17 days of just no iPhones, no internet. You know, you go through a 1 week of plant medicines, 2 weeks of it later, the talking circles, all that stuff. But he tells me, like, the only place in the world that can treat me is Arizona's Mayo Clinic. And I'm like, well, I'm from Arizona, so what a coincidence. And in the next week, we started talking, and I said, I'll help you. Like, if you need to come to Arizona, I can be of service. And that was my orientation when I went to Peru, was like, just be present and be grateful and be of service. And that's my orientation now for life, while also enjoying and playing. But that's my orientation, is if I show up to breathwork, be present, be of service, the rest comes. And so anyway, he moved into my house with his whole Peruvian family 4 months later. And for 6 months, I was a caretaker, and he became like my best friend. And I never would have thought that when I was going to Peru. I was more worried about like 9 plant medicines in 2 weeks. That's going to be too much, right? I didn't think that my integration process was going to be like full-time caretaker for a whole family. And it was beautiful, and I felt grateful to do it, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. And it was amazing. God created that for us. It was convergence. I felt like I knew him for thousands of years. He felt the same. I'm vibrating as I think of him, because he's changed my whole life. And I got to witness a man love his family and love people, and the amount of relationships that stemmed from that one trip has been life-changing, and my boundaries that served me have been dissolving so that I can open my heart and share space and open my heart to others in ways that I probably couldn't have without him. So I have no idea where I'll be in 7 years, because I didn't know I'd be doing something like that then. And so I'm just trying to be present and be of service, and guarantee I'll find it. And you know, it's beautiful when you start to look at life without having all these goals and expectations for me, because we're about to see the world destabilize. We're about to see a lot of things shift in the next 5 years, and I'll be of service, I guarantee it, and I'll find ways to be an example for others. So that's all I'm trying to do. Stay healthy, happy, strong, and be present and be grateful, and you'll know exactly what to do.
I want to bring you to the last two questions that I typically give out for each interview, which talk about the waves of life. For the waves of life, we have things that happen to us that we can't control, and things that we get to output into this world that we can control, right? So when we're getting pummeled by the waves or we let them pass by, that's life happening, things that we can't control. If we're riding the wave and we're living that moment and we're super present, those are things that we can control, or even maybe duck diving around it, getting around it, going on a channel, right? Just talking surfing talk here. But if you're able to do that, how are you able to navigate life's emotions, actions, moralities with the waves in life, the things you can control and the things you can't? How do you handle it?
I like that metaphor. And I'm very big fan of Stoicism and reading about that exact idea. It's like even logos therapy that Viktor Frankl invented. It's how our relationship to our experience is truly the only thing you actually have control over. So, yeah, I think that all things that happen are opportunity. I do believe in the infinite game, not the finite game. I know that we're all here for a short while, but then you go. But I do believe that our souls and our spirits do carry on. I've had experiences that showed me that directly, and it helped me to lose my fear of death. And it helped me to realize that this life is, we're more afraid to fully come alive and to, you know, activate what's most true to us, or to go after the things that we're most afraid of, if you will. So death can be the thing that drives people and makes them sort of obsess with these things in our culture. But I just try to trim the fat and go, like, this is within my reach. If I'm driving somewhere and the car flips over and we're screwed and we end up in the hospital, you don't know. You could meet your future wife in the hospital and you should be grateful. In real time, you don't know. It always seems like, oh, poor me, I'm a victim here, but you don't know. And I've had so many experiences that helped me to remember breaking your foot, and you're like, why me? But then you learned how to swim, and then you met your best friend, and then you go to his wedding, and it's like, thank God I broke my foot. I would have never met my friend Matt, who is like one of the most special people on the planet to me. And so it's like we have to just zoom out and go, okay, this is my experience. I'm going to take it. I'm going to make the best of it. And there's a lot more that's out of our control than what's within our control. So I just try to focus on the mind, the body, try to be present, you know, and I'm consistent with that. Just stay disciplined. And it's not that hard. It's just, it seems like we want to go after all the things that are, even the podcast type stuff. It's like, oh, I can build out a studio. And it's like, why don't you just focus on buying some equipment first and seeing how you can manage that, instead of getting distracted with all the bigger stuff.
Thank you, Ryan, for sharing your light, your love, your energy, your expertise, your knowledge, all of it, for being here with us on the show and for being fully present in all of this. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me, and it's really nice to connect with you, and I look forward to meeting you in person, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak to people that I've never met before, so that'll be cool. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining me on another episode as we learned and explored all things movement, mindset, and medicine. As always, my goal for each episode of this podcast is to share innovative tools and techniques to help you thrive and find stability with your overall health and personal development, alongside the growth of the world around us. please share this with someone you know will benefit from this episode, as well as rate and review. This helps us reach more people and provide feedback as to how we can better help each of you. Make sure to check out our community website, www.mermaidmethod.com, to learn more about our upcoming events, eco-friendly products, and coaching programs. Now let's make massive waves together.